Do you invest in ETFs? Whether you're thinking, what in the world is an ETF? Or you're looking for the next opportunity to add to your portfolio. GlobalX has you covered. From big tech to bonds and bars of gold, GlobalX offers a wide range of exchange-traded funds. Go beyond ordinary with GlobalX ETFs. Visit globalxetfs.com.au. That's globalxetfs.com.au.
InvestSmart's portfolios are turning 10. And to celebrate, 10 InvestSmart boot camps are up for grabs. This self-paced online course is ideal for both seasoned investors and those who are just starting out. Valued at $99, you could win a spot on this highly rated course. To enter the competition and for terms and conditions, simply visit investsmart.com.au/win. Don't miss out on this chance to learn from experts and take your investing to the next level. Simply visit investsmart.com.au/win. Good luck.
Hey there, here's a quick note. This podcast contains general financial advice only. That means it's not specific to you, your needs, goals, or objectives, so don't act on the information until you've spoken with your financial advisor. You'll find our full disclosure, disclaimer, and link to our financial services guide in the show notes. This episode of the podcast was recorded at the Australian Shareholders Association Sydney Conference. So if you hear people chattering or maybe even a bell or some plates and cutlery, you know what it is. It's a bit of background noise. Try to tune that out. We've done our best with editing. Hopefully one day you'll see us on the road in a city near you. Keep your eyes peeled on the RAS Media website for any updates for events that we'll be hosting in the back half of the year. But in the meantime, you can enjoy this episode and know that it was done in real life. Thanks for listening. Andrew Page, welcome back to the show.
Owen, thanks for having me.
Mate, it's always a pleasure. I was telling the guys yesterday how excited I was to chat to you today.
Oh, me too, mate.
It's always
been
a pleasure.
Too long.
Yeah, it has. It actually has been too long. Yeah. So
time goes by so quickly.
Yeah. So people that don't know who Andrew is, Andrew is the founder of strawman.com, Australia's premier investment club.
You've read the briefing.
Yes, nice. I have. And Andrew and I previously worked together.
Did.
He started Strawman at a very similar time.
Yes.
To when I started RASC. So we're in the trenches together for a very long time. Yeah. Shared a few miseries.
Yes.
But mate, can you just maybe for people that haven't heard of Strawman so far, like we've had a lot of new listeners to the podcast over the last couple of years.
Yep.
Tell us what it is and why people join.
Yeah. I mean, it's easy with an online business to get caught up in a lot of tech terms because they sound good. So I'd love to tell you it's a platform, it's a social tool, but it at its heart, it's really just an investment club. And they've been around for ages. So you get around the kitchen table with your friends, you go meet at a coffee shop or a bar and you talk stocks.
Yep.
And the idea being is that you would share ideas, challenge each other's thoughts, maybe get some new insights, but then go off and do your own thing. And I think a lot of people will find this. It's hard to do that in person when people are spread out so thinly across the country. And there just really wasn't many good online options. So we're simply an investment club. We give people sample portfolios that they can build. It hopefully is a bit of practice, a bit of paper trading, so to speak. But it's also there to sort of signal to others in the community, what stocks do I like? How much of them do I hold? How have I gone over time? And we can aggregate all of that together and sort of say, well, look, as a community, here are the most widely held stocks.
Mm.
And we also encourage people to share valuations, research on that as well. That's peer reviewed. People can vote on that. And the idea is that we can just draw out of that things that are trending, things that are popular. Again, not as a recommendation, let me make that clear, but as a starting point. And I think one of the big challenges that we have as investors, there's 2,000 plus stocks. Mm. Everyone knows Telstra, BHP and all that, but there's some really great stuff at the small end, but it's much harder to find. So that's all it is, all care, no responsibility. We're here to sort of connect you with other engaged investors. We charge a pretty significant price for it as well, very intentionally, because we want to keep the scale small, but also because it's a wonderful self-selection mechanism as well. You only get the very, very serious investors. And yeah, so far doing pretty well.
Yeah, the one thing that people can do, whether they're a paid member or a free member, is they can look at the Strawman Index.
Oh, yes.
which is shown on the homepage of strawman.com, and it shows like outperformance since 2017.
Yes.
And that basically is like, as you might say, the hive mind, the collective wisdom of the community.
Yes.
The list of companies goes into that index.
Yes.
And it compares, I can't remember the benchmark.
ISX 300.
ISX 300.
Yep.
And there were times where it's, we'll talk about the volatility in a minute, but there are times where it shot away from the benchmark and come back
insanely
down.
Insanely good at one point. Yeah. Now the last year hasn't been great. But yeah, we're still outperforming the market since inception.
I often think about this because we've seen some like community-based indices created in the past for Australian stocks, and some of them haven't performed so well.
Yes.
And I often think to myself about Strawman, like what makes it so good.
Mm.
I tend to think that it's a result of the quality of the research which goes into the, like how people join and if they're allowed to join, when they join, what they have to do to earn rewards.
Yes.
And to get recognized. And ultimately, all of that quality focus on the member.
Yes.
Lends itself to better quality research, which drives the stocks up.
100%.
Or like the in indice.
It sounds a little bit elitist, doesn't it? But it's not really. It's the trouble is the hive mind is only as good as the hive.
Yeah.
And so this is the problem with a lot of the free sort of platforms that are out there. You've got everyone coming in and giving their 2 cents worth, whether it's well supported or not. And there's no accountability. So we really try to build accountability into the platform. It's not about making some people feel great and others feel terrible about themselves. It's just a matter of sort of saying, look, if you want to share your thoughts, we want to share your thoughts. We want to challenge those thoughts, not to get into arguments, but to refine our thinking to get better outcomes. But at the end of the day, you know, it's only going to be as good as the quality that's put into it. And when you only focus on those that are very serious investors, DIY investors, self-directed investors, you just get a higher caliber.
Yeah.
And that's what it's all about.
You
Groucho Marx has this saying, you know, I wouldn't want to be a member of a club that would have me. And it's always stuck out really well.
That's,
you know.
One.
So I don't know. When you're first building a business, you want it to be bigger than Ben Hur. Wouldn't it be great? We'll have 100,000 members and, you know, to the moon kind of thing. But we quickly realized that actually careful what you wish for there. Because you've extracted out far enough, you just get the market average almost by definition. So, less is more.
Mm. And if I'm not mistaken, that index actually has quite a tilt to smaller caps as well.
So with our sample portfolios, you can buy anything listed on the ASX. We never set out to go that direction, but the community very much evolved towards small caps. And I think it's because there's a couple of reasons. The first one being is that they're very undercovered. If you want research on an ASX 100 company, they're everywhere. They're always written in the AFR and various publications. You will get a view on that. These ones are so much under the radar that really there's not a lot of other places you can go to find some intelligent commentary on these things. So I think people gravitated towards it for that. And also, frankly, small caps are definitely more risky. But within all of that, and a lot of rubbish in there too, let's be real.
Absolutely, yeah.
But within all of that, there are some absolute sort of gems. And almost by definition, smaller companies have bigger growth potential. They tend to be much easier to understand, the smaller operations.
Mm.
We tend to have the ability to speak with any CEO that we want to. In fact, we do weekly CEO meetings that members nominate. And you just get that level of access, you get that level of clarity, you get that bigger growth opportunity. And it's just, it's a very exciting space. And it's one that you can bring to bear very rational, Buffett-esque kind of approaches, even though they may be smaller and more volatile. And it's worked out pretty well.
I love it because it does cover the companies that I personally want to be learning about pretty early in their journey.
Yeah.
And a lot of the other like places where you can go to learn are typically, we've seen some instances recently in the news where there's a lot of hype around them and people posting, you know, if they hold a company, they have really done no research, they just want to talk about it, so it creates a buzz and all those types of things.
Yeah.
The last couple of years has been very volatile, in particular the last 18 months, I'd say.
Isn't it funny? We only use the word volatile when things are going down.
Yeah.
We don't use the term volatility on the way up.
No.
But
COVID,
you're right.
COVID was great on the way up.
Yeah, true.
So what have been some of the kind of the lessons learned from this period? And maybe just to add context where this question comes from, I've spoken to a lot of what I would categorize as maybe really talented analysts or private investors who are maybe newer.
Yep.
that have become a little bit disenfranchised by high inflation, higher rates over the past few years. And so I'm angling for like what's happened in the community, how's it been faring, and maybe I guess the lessons that you've taken by being through this before.
Yes, there is a lot of lessons to be had. I think one of the more dangerous scenarios for a new investor is to start investing into a bull market, because you very quickly start to learn that you're a genius no matter what you do.
Yeah.
And wow, if I made 30% on my little pile of money over here, maybe I should throw much more money over here and continue to do that. Look how easy this is.
Yep.
And it leads very much to a pride before fall moment. The best time really to invest, counterintuitively, is very tough times. You know, battle hardens you.
Mm.
It shows you it's not easy. It shows you the advantage of being confident when others are fearful. So what did we learn? I think we learned a couple of things. There is always a disconnect between what the business is doing and what the shares are doing. And we had a lot of really great businesses that were popular within the community. But at the same time, the shares just got silly. It's more obvious in hindsight than it was at the time. But Buffett says you pay a high price for a cheery consensus.
Mm.
And I think one of the lessons that this isn't a new lesson, this is a lesson I've had to relearn and probably will need to relearn again in the future, is that you can actually do pretty badly or pretty poorly, even if you pick the right company. Valuation matters. And that's easy to say. I think it's pretty obvious. But at the same time, there is nothing more difficult than sitting on the sidelines when everyone else is having a great party, easy money, and you're the old curmudgeon saying, oh, it's a little bit too pricey, or this doesn't make sense. And, you know, that FOMO element is so potent. And that was just reiterated to me very strongly, I think. The other thing I would add to that is that it is also these times that represent the best opportunity, in the sense that there's a lot of stuff that deserve to fall. Just ridiculous valuations and frankly just zombie companies, as Chris Joy was talking about earlier at the event. But the babies always get thrown out with the bathwater, and it sucks to watch them sort of go down. But I try and remind myself that as a long-term investor and who's hopefully still got decades to go, now, this is exactly what I should be hoping for.
Mm.
We all say it, right? Like, oh, if the shares fall a little bit, I'm going to back up the truck. And then it does. And then we don't. So there's another reminder to sort of say, actually, look at this for what it is. It's not risk. It's not volatility. Sure, it is those things. But it's opportunity.
Mm. Yeah, a lot of people, at least accumulators, we're here at the ASA event, and there's a lot of people that are in retirement mode and some accumulators, of course. But it's an interesting dichotomy between those two, because if you're in that situation, you probably see volatility and downward prices as a major risk,
yes,
threat to your portfolio and wealth.
If you have to sell your shares to get the cash to live on, absolutely.
Yeah. Whereas if you're an accumulator and you're kind of a shrewd investor who's hold on to these things,
yes,
you should actually be hoping for lower prices, because the implied yield...
Let it fall, baby.
Yeah.
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 How easy is that to say?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's hard when it happens.
It is, yeah. When you see, not to single you out, but I saw your straw man profile this morning before coming to record here, mate, and I did see the 12-month figures were negative. So
I think they're down 30-something%.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's okay. Compounded at an average rate of 13% since 2017, but the last year's been brutal.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, this is a point in time when we take that number too. So I imagine 12 months ago, maybe even 12 months from now, it's a different number.
It may be, but I'm not going to cherry pick it. I made the point when I did the intro for the conference here today that I don't care who you are, you're going to have these periods of underperformance. I've been doing this for more than 20 years. Not my first rodeo. I've suffered through this before.
Yeah.
And definitely mistakes were made. Genuine mistakes were poor investment pieces. They weren't mistakes of timing, because I just never get that right. Mm. I think you learn that you don't need to get that kind of right. But it is what it is. I mean, the regrets that I tend to have anyway, are not so much the losses that have been made. It's the not swinging hard enough when the opportunities sort of come. And just being able to be consistent. When you look at that trailing 12 months and go, gosh, what a shocker. It's very easy to capitulate, very easy to throw in the towel. But just watching the Berkshire meeting on the weekend, what's Charlie and Warren's big secret? Consistency and endurance, you know? And I just, again, I'm not saying anything world-breaking here, but it's true, and it's good to have that reminder.
Mm. How much, this is a really technical question, and I don't expect a technical answer, Andrew, but how much of your return in small caps, I guess, do you think is through multiple expansion or valuation expansion, sentiment changes versus, say, fundamental
growth? Oh, such a good question. Valuation is a big part of it. On the way up and on the way down. So there are some companies that just did so incredibly well for me. And I bought them because I thought they were good businesses that the earnings would grow and grow pretty well. Small cap growth time. I thought they would do that. Well, they did. What I didn't factor in was things like price to sales ratios going from 2 to 20.
Yeah.
Like it's a 10x return, just you know, that aspect alone. And as I said, things got a bit crazy. And I think the pendulum's swinging the other way now. Now you've got some really incredible companies there with these. I'm using price to sales, which is a very blunt measure, by the way. Sure. But sometimes you have to when they're pre-earnings companies. It's actually compressed right down. So you've got to kind of get both right as an investor. You can, as I said, you can do really badly investing in a great company. A company could grow at 20% from now until kingdom come, but if it's on a price to sales of 4 million, just to pick a stupid example, I'm probably not going to do well at that. So I think that's what's changed. I mean, I think that's what's interesting. A lot of the companies I've got in my portfolio, I'm honestly not upset with. The business has done more or less what I thought and hoped that they would do and are continuing to do it. And the future that I envisaged seems to be playing out more or less. Never does exactly, but it's, you know, directionally kind of correct. The only difference between now and a couple of years ago is that the market is so down on these that the multiples are so ridiculously low. So it's a better risk-adjusted return. Same company, much better return potential now.
Mm.
And by the way, I should be careful. That doesn't mean I'm saying, that things are going to turn and it won't get lower from here. It's just objectively, all else being equal, it's much better at a lower multiple.
What do you, I know we're just speaking general terms here. What would be your average holding period of a smaller company?
Yeah, I've not worked it out, but it would be years.
It'd be in years.
Years. There's really only three reasons I ever sell. One is just it's clearly the thesis is broken. And that might be if the share price is up from where I bought it or down. Doesn't matter. I bought for this reason. My reasoning was wrong. If I stay invested, that's just hope at that point. And hope is not an investment strategy, as I'm fond of saying. So if that's a clear and decisive sell. You just got to be honest with yourself, which is the tricky part there. Did I get it wrong?
Mm.
The other time is if there's an opportunity cost consideration. I'm a big believer in diversification, obviously. But I really think for most of us, it just gets silly beyond about 20 stocks.
Yeah.
20 stocks, you've only got on average 5% allocation to each. One of them could go to zero and you've still got 95% of your portfolio. You get most of the benefits of diversification within that first 15 to 20 stocks. Beyond that, you just get this situation where you are so diluted in everything that yes, you're very much protected against the downside, but you're also chasing multi-baggers, hopefully.
Mm.
What point is it if you've got 100 stocks and one of them goes up 10x? Do the maths. It doesn't do anything. So sometimes you'll sell something not because you've changed your mind or it's not great anymore. It's just that something objectively better has come along. And you've got a team on the field. You've got some players on the bench.
Yeah.
Some of the ones on the field are tired. I'm going to sub them off with someone fresh, better. And so that's another reason to sell. And then the final one is just because I need the money to do something with, buy a car or a new dishwasher or whatever it happens to be, right?
Yeah.
Outside of that, why would you sell? So when I talk about the biggest regrets in my life are selling things at insanely good returns. I mean, I'd give you 100 examples, but things where I Pro Medicus is one I like to talk about, right? Yep. Because I bought it at 83 cents, which makes me sound like a genius because it's 65 bucks today. It's literally an 80x return. But what did I do? I was clever and I locked in profits. The old saying is you never go broke taking a profit. Yeah, but you never get the long-term compounding multi-baggers either.
Mm.
And so I the best returns happen when a business really starts to gain traction, really starts to compound its returns. It was sitting there under the radar, and as it's doing this, it gets more and more attention. And that's when you get these gains that are just incredible. You've got to be patient, but they are the ones to keep and to cling to for dear life as well, you know. And also, I'm a bit lazy. So the whole, for me, the thing that first drew me into shares was that, I give my money to someone. I get to own part of this business. I'm not going into their office every day. I'm not digging the holes or answering the phones. They're doing it for me. So if I own a great business and there are people out there working hard every day to enrich me, let them do it, right? Mm. And if I'm going to be changing horses every 5 seconds, it's just very counterproductive, very costly, and the rest of it. So it's a very long-winded answer, mate, but I like to hold for as long as the return potential looks attractive and the company remains on track.
Mm.
And that could be 20 years.
Mm, I like it. I also think that I guess those two questions in sequence, where I was thinking is, a lot of the studies show that fundamentally companies perform better over 5 to 10 years. Like that's when the fundamentals really kick in.
Yes.
So you need that longer holding period. Yep. Of course, you get your afterpays and small businesses that can shoot the lights out fundamentally, sure. Like profit, revenue, all those things.
Yes.
But typically what we find statistically anyway is that in the short to medium term, it actually is sentiment and valuation expansion that drives a lot of share price performance. Yep. And I see that particularly so with small caps where you have people that are more active. Like you and I both know Claude. Claude's much more active than I am as an investor, for example. Here. And it works for him, I think, because in small cap land, he can be more active because of that stretching and that contraction in valuations.
Yep.
Whereas, say, someone that's investing in Telstra and that, the volatility isn't there because and you don't see that stretch in the valuations as much.
Yep.
And that was kind of the genesis of that question. But there is a couple other things which I want to touch base with you on. We've never, you and I, I've heard you talk about it elsewhere and I've seen it on Twitter, alongside your, I guess concerns about the rental situation in Australia, shall we say, and property
very
prices.
Very delicately put. Yes. I love it.
But the other thing that's new to me into our conversation here today is your fascination and your interest in Bitcoin, a cryptocurrency. So I'm hoping maybe can you lay out as succinctly as you can the thesis around this and just like your general thinking.
Yeah. Oh, you want me to do this quickly?
Yeah.
It's very hard.
It's a big topic. Let's give us the cliff notes.
I just want to say right at the beginning here is that this is a very polarizing topic. You tend to put people off straight away, or you tend to preach to the converted, and it doesn't tend to be a very intellectually rigorous conversation. People make up their minds very quickly. We chatted years ago about it, and I was telling you it was the biggest Ponzi of all time. And this is around 2017 when we had that big bubble. And then it all came down and was like totally vindicated, right? Like what a nonsense. Well, guess what? It didn't go away. And I was like, okay, one of the things you notice with bubbles and Ponzi's is that when they are discovered, that's it.
Yeah.
Bernie Madoff didn't come back and start all over again. It's done. The jig is up. Well, this one didn't happen. Let me clarify as well. There's Bitcoin and then there's shit coins. They're just totally different things. And that is a meme, but there is a lot of good reason for that. So the cliff notes.
Okay.
And I've got to be careful because I just tend to put a lot of our members and stuff off because a lot of them don't like it. So you do you. I've got nothing to shill here. He's got no buy-in as to whatever anyone
Absolutely.
Does.
Absolutely. And this is only, I'd imagine, a very small part of your portfolio. And less of your interest is this and more is small caps and companies.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I try to pride myself on being an independent thinker, and I try to pride myself on looking at the other side of the argument and taking it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
So about a year and a half ago, I did this with Bitcoin because this damn thing wasn't going away. So I was like, right, let's dig into it a little bit so I can finally put it to bed and get on with my life. And the trouble is the more I dug into it, the more I found I was orange pilling myself. You know, I got more and more convinced of it. And it's very easy to get into the technicals and cryptography and computer science and economics and history and the rest of it. But I think an elegant way of describing it is that we now have a way to transmit value in the same way that we transmit information. So the internet obviously is a big deal. It just meant that anyone, anywhere through an open protocol without any permission. I don't need anyone say so. I can get online and I can communicate with anyone else on the planet. It's huge. With computers, of course, you can replicate anything a gazillion times for no marginal cost, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what Bitcoin is genuine digital scarcity. In fact, it's probably one of the most scarce things in the universe. And when you understand that the fundamental truth of that statement, it's not some wild-eyed, laser-eyed, you know, person on Twitter saying it is. Like, and we don't have time to get into it, but it genuinely is that. And that I can access it without anyone say so. I've got an asset here that has no counterparty risk. Think about the assets that you've got invested in now that have no counterparty, like literally no counterparty risk. It is without an issuer.
Mm-hmm.
It is a bearer instrument. It settles very quickly. It transfers at the speed of light. So it's got all these incredible properties. And over the last 14 years, this thing has just ticked over flawlessly. It's got the world's greatest bug bounty on it. Because if you can crack this thing, you're literally going to make billions of dollars, right? It never happened. Kind of can't happen. I wouldn't say never, never, but I mean, again, dig into it. You start getting these really profound statements that, holy crap, that's true. I can actually make these kinds of statements. And so you get to this point where it's sort of like, this is a big deal. Now, like all technologies, it doesn't matter how good they are. They need to be adopted. And the other angle to it as well is that when people just look at the price, the exchange rate of this thing, but when you look at any of the metrics that kind of would suggest, would give you some indication of that adoption, whether it's be the number of wallets, the number of transactions, the hash rate on the network, any of these things, bottom left, top right, in a J, you know, it's like, okay. And the other thing you got to realize too is that it doesn't have to be, it's not an all or nothing thing. I think some people like to think, well, all fiat money is going to zero tomorrow and we're all going to go to a Bitcoin standard. Well, we live in a world right now where there's hundreds of currencies. We have no problem with multiple currencies. If I gave you a $20 Kiwi note right now, I don't think you would want it. Why? Because it's very difficult to spend here. Does the Kiwi dollar have no value? No, it doesn't. It just happens to be in a certain jurisdiction where the value is held. But even then, I can take it and I can swap it and I can do things. Well, we now have a native currency for the internet, for the digital realm. That's pretty powerful. And I can, again, there's no borders. it's phenomenal. And so the thesis is very simple. We've got a once in a civilization kind of technology, genuine digital scarcity. The best use case for that tends to be as a monetary asset. And I now have something that is faster, safer, more secure, more trustworthy than anything that's ever existed before. And if only 10,000 people in the world accept that, that's fine. I've got a community of 10,000 people, but that is actually millions now. And it will continue to be more in the future. So as long as adoption grows, as long as the network continues to operate, it's almost certain to have a great deal of value.
I've only got two more questions for you. One of them is a question related to this, which is what do you think of the Ethereum blockchain? It seems to be more efficient.
It's a scam.
Do you think so?
Yeah, it's a complete scam. I mean, the Ethereum has changed its code on a bunch of occasions because it can be changed. Because there are people that control it. That's fine, but it's a software enterprise. It's a security. It's not a commodity. It's got some cool stuff that you can do, but here's the other thing. Blockchain is the worst technology in the world for efficiency. It's ridiculously inefficient by design, right? So to do something on a Ethereum blockchain that I can do much faster, cheaper, and better on an AWS web server just makes no sense. This project's been going for years. Show me one use case. The use case has been, let's create a bunch of altcoins that we can sell to a dumb public. That's what it does. Now, you try and change the code of Bitcoin. You can't. No one can. No one owns it. Gary Gensler, the head of the SEC, has said, Bitcoin's a commodity. Everything else is a security. Now, why would I invest in a token that is controlled by a handful of people where the consensus mechanism is based on the more coins you have, the more say you have? Sounds very similar to certain systems we've got at the moment that don't work well. You remember, mate, that when the internet came along, every company put .com on the end of its name and everyone tried to like get a bit of halo effect from that. Well, someone just invented something phenomenal and everyone realized that actually it's open source software. I can just fork it, put my own name on it, put a picture of a dog or a rocket or something on it, and I can sell this to a whole bunch of people. And we found out last year, the hard way, just how much grift and scam there is. And Ethereum's probably one of the bigger ones that's out there. Sorry to all the ETH heads. I know I'm going to get some angry letters there.
Yeah, but so it's going to be a zero is what you're saying.
Look, I don't know if it's going to be a zero, but I know if I'm going to be, I want to own something that, again, has no counterparty risk.
Yeah.
And that has massive counterparty risk.
Yeah, fair. Yeah, maybe a zero is a bit harsh for me. But
I think ultimately, like it could take a long time.
Yep.
Yeah, I think it could actually be something that's used as a backbone for all of the CBDCs and stuff. They'll find a use case for it in that sense. But in terms of the market opportunity and potential of it, it's chalk and cheese. And this is why there is that meme, Bitcoin, not crypto. Yep. They are fundamentally different, you know?
Fair enough. The other thing that one extra buzzword I'll throw at you before we wrap it up here. Now, just before we get to this question, people, they have to join a wait list to join Strawman to get access to the small cap and company research. So if you are interested, I know a lot of my listeners and listeners of the other RAS podcasts are really passionate about Strawman.
Oh, we've got a wait list. Yeah. Sign up.
Yeah. And so go ahead and sign up. There'll be a link in the show notes to get a free account and join the wait list. There may be an opening. I have the inside scoop. Maybe an opening later this year.
Yes. We do it about twice a year.
Yeah. So once you get your membership, don't give it up. It's basically the thing. Okay, great. So the question is, do you think artificial intelligence will replace a lot of stock picking?
Yeah, I think it will.
You reckon it will?
Actually, I think it's one of, speaking of the internet, it's one of those technologies that's just so broad in its applicability. So I think it disrupts everything. I mean, not tomorrow, but the genie's out of the bottle now. I think equity analysts to lawyers to everything will be impacted. I think it's not that a robot will take your job, or a computer will take your job, or an AI will take your job. A human using an AI will take your job. And what it's shown is that I can be me, but just 10 times, 100 times more efficient because I've got an army of servants who don't sleep or think or get angry at my command. So, for example, in your job, Owen, you might go, I'm a kind of investor. I like good quality companies. They've proven there's some commercialization, there's traction with sales. I'm putting stuff in your, words in your mouth here. Now, in the good old days, you had to sort of do a lot of reading, right? You can do scans and that, but they're hard because they're just their ratios. And when we really sort of have particularly sort of subjective attributes that you're looking for, like management quality and all this, it's just a lot of reading. So now I can spin up any number of servants, ones that I've specifically trained on ASX data and any particular annual reports that I want to do, and just say, Jarvis, why don't you get for me companies that are between $10 and $20 million. I just spit out my shopping list. Go, here you go. Now, was that possible before? Yeah, it just took a long time. And fund management teams would have armies of people to sort of do that. Now, I can do it automatically. I'm still going to be the human that makes the decision. I don't know, maybe 50 years out, maybe that changes too. But for the foreseeable future, I'm still there. I can just outsource so much of this stuff. Will AI be in charge of actual buy-sell decisions? I'm sure some hedge funds will set something up and allocate a portion of capital. But for the main, I think it's more of a story of it being a tool that people can use to vastly enhance their productivity, which means that they can, and by the way, but it doesn't give no one a particular edge because we're all using it, but it is going to mean that there's going to be a lot less jobs in our industry, I think, and for a lot of industries.
Mm. That's fair, yeah.
It's not a great outlook.
No. I remember listening to David Gardner, who I know you know from the Motley Fool co-founder, used to have this saying that everything that he invests in, you can't see on a balance sheet.
Yes.
You can't see in the data. And
Love that.
I think we should maybe distinguish between quantitative analysis and quantitative investing in AI, which is the key thing. Like you said,
the qualitative.
Yeah, the AI is the qualitative. That's where the game has changed.
Yep.
Whereas we've always had quant engines, just ask Jim Simons in the 1980s.
Yep.
So that's a frontier, which is quite interesting.
Really?
It's still a lot of asymmetry, I would say, in small caps,
yep,
in Australia in particular. So for small cap investors, I think that is still, that kind of white water is still a fair way out.
Yeah. You know what's interesting though? And so we, as I say, we do a lot of CEO interviews, and lately, I mean, they know which way the wind is blowing, right? So for they sure know what investors want to hear, and investors want to hear AI at the moment.
Absolutely.
So everyone's dropping it in. What I was under a false impression for a long time was that, well, how are you as a small $20 million ASX company competing with the likes of Google and OpenAI? Like, you can't possibly do all this stuff and be anywhere near as good as these guys. And then it dawned on me, it's like, actually, they're not doing any of that. They're taking the tool by those guys and they're applying it to themselves. It's like, well, no, our tech team just plugs it in. It's virtually an API. We don't have to know how large language models work. We can just use it.
Yeah.
And when you see this speed of integration on this, like, wow, this is a big deal. So I think for the small caps that I'm most interested in, it's the ones that have proprietary data sets.
Yeah.
Because that is just right up AI's alley, right? Mm. So Pointera might be a good example. No, it's down in the dumps at the moment, but huge, I mean, terabytes and terabytes and terabytes of data that a machine is just like, you know, eat for lunch. Whether it's EnviroSuite, collecting environmental monitoring data and this kind of stuff. And it will, or Ava Risk Group does security detection. They have all of these data sets that they can train the AI on to improve. They're just capturing the data. That's going to be a commodity. And the data capture, okay, anyone can do more or less do that. Drawing intelligence out of that data, that's the game changer. And these companies that have the data and will be able to gain that increased intelligence, I think that's the one way you can get a bit of a head start on your competitors, who likewise can use the tools. They just don't have the training sets to leverage.
Yeah, that's a great point. Mate, this is heaps of fun recording at the ASA event here in Sydney. People can find you on Twitter. Is it still Sage_Simeon?
God, I've got to change the name. Yes, it is.
Yes, it is. Yes. Okay,
I come and go in terms of my Twitter activity, but yeah, check me out there.
Yeah, find him there. You're still hosting your podcast with Scott?
I am. We still with Triple M Motley Fool Money.
Yep.
We do that twice a week.
Yep.
So and one with Baby Giants, got Matt Joss and Claude Walker.
Yep. So there'll be links to all of those in the show notes, Matt. Really appreciate you taking the time to join me.
Mate, I could go all day, and thank you for humouring me with Bitcoin.
That's great, mate. Cheers.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. Before you go, I wanted to share some things with you. Specifically, I wanted to tell you about the 10 ways that Rask could help you in 2024. As many of you know, Rask has grown to become one of the biggest investing and finance platforms in Australia. Across our podcasts, our websites, our memberships, and so on, we now engage around 200,000 Aussies, which, considering we started in a humble lounge room on a Kmart desk, one of those old fake white wooden ones, I'm pretty ecstatic about where we are 6 years later. As part of becoming one of Australia's biggest platforms for wealth creation and preservation, we now have a very special position in the country in that we can bring you some of the best, most thoughtful, expert-driven ways to protect and grow your wealth. And I'm going to share some of those with you now. I've got 10 ways that we can potentially help you or match you with someone who can. The first thing that I want to tell you about is the biggest step we've ever taken at Rask, which is the launch of our Rask Invest platform. This is a platform that lets our team, led by me, invest for you, primarily through low-cost, diversified ETFs. We'll have three strategies at launch, and every investor who comes through can pick one of the three strategies, being a balanced strategy, a growth strategy, and a high growth strategy. The balanced strategy focuses on passive income, and the high growth strategy focuses on longer term compounding. You will find a link in your podcast player to register your interest.
we will be taking off soon. Number two, if you prefer to DIY your investing, you can join me and over 4,000 members inside RAS Core. That's our full ETF and ASX share research membership community. You can join now and you'll get updated ETF portfolio recommendations every quarter, as well as ongoing ASX and global stock research. Every single month, we call them the All-Star Stocks. You get that alongside the ETF portfolios, as well as other members-only content. It's called RAS Core. Number three, our first ever partnership with a business other than our own was a business by the name of Blusk, which has since become Flint Group. Flint Group is led by Chris Bates and Christian Stevens, two of Australia's most highly regarded mortgage brokers. Already over 200 RAS community members have begun the RASC plus Flint Group mortgage broking process. You can click the link in your podcast player if you're refinancing, investing, a first home buyer, or whatever. You've probably heard Chris on the show many times. Number four, you can connect with our most trusted financial advisors. Whether you're 25 years old, just graduated uni and looking to set yourself up, or approaching or in retirement and you've got that nest egg you want to protect and generate a passive income from, you can get in contact with our trusted panel of financial advisors. You can find the link in your podcast player. It's there each and every week. Just click the thing that says financial planning. Number five, if you want specialist insurance advice, as Warren Buffett said, rule number one is don't lose money. And rule number two is don't forget rule number one. Insurance is vitally important, especially when it comes to your number one asset, you. Whether you're a single income household or a couple, and you just want to protect what would happen if. You want to protect your family if something goes wrong. You want to protect your spouse if you lose your job. You want to protect yourself if you hurt yourself on the weekend at footy. Insurance is a way to do that. And I think the best way to do insurance is through a financial planner. And there's a few reasons for that. But one of them is sometimes some insurers will only work with financial advisors, but they can also be your companion as you go through the sometimes daunting process of getting insurance done properly. Sometimes you might not even know, but you're not even covered, even though you think you are. So get the right advice. You'll find a link in the show notes to check that out. Number six, buying property. If you're like me and you're thinking of buying property in the next 12 months, or maybe you've already invested and you're looking to downsize, getting the right advice and being able to build wealth through property is a proven strategy. It might be one of the most contentious, but I think that we have one of Australia's best property coaches in our ranks. That is Pete Wargent. Pete is the host of the now super popular Australian property podcast by RASC, and he's also my analyst team's macro consultant. So if you're a member of RAS Core, you will have seen Pete's name around the traps. He's a property coach and buyer's agent, and he works with a select number of people each and every year. Just a note on this, this is not a commercial thing with Pete. Pete just has great services, so we offer them to the community. And when he fills up, he fills up. You can find out more about Pete's coaching in the show notes. Next up, tracking your portfolio for tax? I think you are, because I think you have to. So we've partnered with Nivexa to help you manage your share and ETF reporting, whether it's tax or performance. All RASC users get 20% off an annual plan with Nivexa. You can sync your portfolio with Nivexa's software and it automatically tracks your dividends, your capital gains tax, and more. Again, not a commercial partnership. We don't make anything from working with Nivexa, but they do create some great tools which the RASC community uses each and every day. Number eight, want to run your own business? Maybe you already do. If you want more profit, but less stress, less time consumed, and less energy lost, get in contact. We have a partner business called Inflection. The Inflection Accelerator Program is a complete online course that helps you and a community of members engage and follow a proven strategy for growing your business. I'm grateful to be one of the coaches inside the Accelerator program, helping business owners right across Australia. You can find more following the link in your podcast player. It's the one that says coaching. Number nine, if you haven't already checked it out, join over 20,000 other people who tune into the Rask YouTube channel. It is completely free and you get notified when we go live and when we publish podcast episodes. There is a podcast on the Rask network each and every day, as well as bite-sized material that's less than 60 seconds, or those really punchy tutorials and webinars that are just 15 minutes that take you through a really exciting topic, whether it's how to buy a property, whether it's how to pick a dividend ETF. Some of our most popular content actually just explains things like, what the heck is franking credits and how do I calculate if I've got some? That's on our YouTube channel. Number 10, if you want to be a better investor, a saver, a better partner with money, or just understand your own relationship with money, you can do that. All of that by going to the Rask Education website and taking a free course. We've enrolled over 26,000 students at the time of this recording, and we're on a mission to get to 100,000 in the next few years. Rask Education is our mostly free education platform, covering everything from budgeting and automation to the probably, I would say, the best value investing program in the country. So whether you're a value investor, an intermediate investor, you want to know how to value Woolworths shares, or you simply just want to understand what ethical investing is, or buy your first property and what actually happens on settlement day, head to the Rask Education website and enroll in something today. It is free and it supports us, because then I can come on here next month and I can say we've got 27,000, and hopefully we reach critical mass where we can help more Australians manage their money better. Thank you for listening to this long-winded ad. If you want to get in contact with me, you know where to go. There's a link in your show notes. Basically, these 10 services, even though some of them we don't make any money from, support Rask and allow us to produce these podcasts, attract the biggest and best guests from Australia and around the world, and bring them to you to answer your questions. Thank you for being part of the Rask network, and thank you for your ongoing support. Bye for now.